Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and look into the regional consequences of the fall of Gaddafi as looted arms are proliferating south into Niger, where Agadez has become a flourishing arms bazaar. We will speak with Professor Hamoud Salhi, who is a specialist on Algeria. And the Algerian government, of course, is sheltering members of Gaddafi's family and where quite possibly Gaddafi himself is hiding out. Then we'll look into the state of the American dream. Then we'll be joined by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz. He has an article out now called The Price of 9/11, and we'll calculate the costs of the wars since 9/11 that have exceeded Dr. Stiglitz's and Linda Bilmes's earlier conservative calculation of $3 to $5 trillion. And then we'll look into the state of the American dream with the shrinking middle class and speak with Aaron Currier, who is the project manager for the Economic Mobility Project at the Pew Charitable Trusts, who have just released a new study that finds nearly one-third of Americans who grew up middle class in the 1970s have fallen out of the middle class as adults. Joining us now is Hamoud Salhi, who is a professor of political science at Cal State University, Dominguez Hills. He's also a political commentator for Algerian radio and television and a columnist for the independent newspaper El Habar, The News, and a board member of El Shab, a strategic studies center in Algiers. A native of Algeria, his areas of interest are ethnicity, democracy, development studies, and the foreign policies of the Maghreb states. Welcome to Background Briefing, Hamoud Salhi.
Thanks, Masters.
Clearly, there is interest in where Gaddafi is, and there's a lot of military activity surrounding various towns as the rebels, now the Transitional National Council, say they have him cornered. His family, apparently, some time ago moved, at least members of it, moved into Algeria from a border town. Gaddafi himself made a phone call to the Algerian president Bouteflika from that border town. Mm-hmm. Do you think Gaddafi is actually in Algeria?
I would say I'm positive. I could go up to 80% that he is in Algeria, and for some basic reasons, the Algerian government is very, 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 very concerned about the outcome of this revolution. Specifically, they have a concern about the presence of NATO in Libya. There is fear that this would be a permanent station for NATO, or at least one of them. There is also fear that it could be a permanent station for AFRICOM, as the United States had worked or has been working to find a home for a central command in Africa. And up to this point, every nation in Africa has refused to host such a command. So Algerians have fear about that. And then there is the issue of terrorist organizations. An unstable Libya could have a big impact on the stability of Algeria. The third reason is that this government has had a major problem with the transitional government. They had a problem with their dealings and their approaches to NATO. They feel that the current transitional council has been too friendly with the West, and which could translate from the Algerian perspective to giving certain rights to France and United States that might be seen Algeria as threatening to its national security. And specifically, another issue that is sort of looming in the horizon, that this transnational council has had some kind of dealing with what the local press described as a rapprochement with the Israelis, and that does not bode well for the region. So the Algerian government would use the presence of Gaddafi as a leverage to force the transnational council to do things otherwise they may not do. And it is from that perspective that one should not ignore or dismiss the possibility or strong possibility that Gaddafi is in Algeria and the Algerians are holding him as a leverage to force the council to do things in their way.
So I suppose then the other side of the story, Hamoud Salih, would be that the new government in Libya are already annoyed with the Algerians for not supporting them, for supporting Gaddafi, for sheltering his family. And then if it becomes public that they're also sheltering Gaddafi, that's not exactly the best way to get started up with your new neighbors, is it?
Very true. And the Algerians have not been shied from expressing publicly. The foreign minister himself, other personalities, the media has also stressed that they were not really happy with the way the Transnational Council asked NATO to come and to help them. They thought that this group has ties with the Westerners that are sort of not good to work with. But we have to understand one thing, that the Algerians government, particularly the current regime, was saved by what happened in Libya. In other words, if you look at the debate, the narrative, the discussion that existed following the success of the revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt, the next step or the prediction of the time that was Algeria was next or Morocco. But suddenly, Libya happened, and it became a civil war by any indication. What the Algerian government did, including the independent media, is to portray the conflict of Libya as it could be dangerous if it's replicated in Algeria. The democratic change through revolution, the way it was done in Tunisia and Egypt, was not likely to happen in this part of the world. And the narrative suddenly changed from something that could be done. You had demonstrations planned in Algeria to sort of some kind of skepticism. The Algerians became very careful in calling, especially those who were involved in the civil rights movement and civil society movement. They saw Libya as something that could be replicated in Algeria. And if that happens in Algeria, the memories of the 90s, when Algerians went through a decade of a bloody war that led to 200,000 people killed, those memories suddenly resurfaced. And indirectly, Libya, Gaddafi, did save the current regimes from possibly a collapse.
So, in other words, Hamoud Salih, again, he's a political commentator for Algerian radio and television and a columnist for the independent newspaper El Habar, The News, and a board member of El Shab Strategic Studies Center in Algiers. And you're saying that the Algerian regime dodged the bullet of the Arab Spring. They thought it was coming their way after Tunisia and Egypt. And then they used the chaos next door in Libya as a way to suggest to the Algerian people that democracy may bring about another round of political instability. The memories, of course, are pretty deep from the decade of bloodletting.
Of course. Remember the context of this. There was a belief among the Arab world, and in Algeria in this case, that you could achieve revolutionary change by just going to a place, a famous place, Tahrir in Egypt, in Cairo, and demonstrate. It was believed that change could happen if you have a mass protest, and that it could be done peacefully. What the Libyan case reminded the Algerian that the regime, the government in place, would not give up that easily. Now, a good example of this is that prior to the Libyan case, there were several demonstrations in Algeria. Mind you that they were not as strong, but there was a momentum for a bigger one. Now, there are serious problems with the Algerian civil society, we may not have had the revolution that we had, but the momentum was there to create a second kind of democratic revolution. I was there about 3 or 4 weeks ago in Algeria, and there were demonstrations, but they were issue-oriented. What's happened is that groups were fighting on their own. You did not have a national cohesive movement that would actually topple the regime. And the background to this, if we all put it in a perspective, the narrative in the media and the official media and the independent media was that, look, we really don't want to go back to the era of the 90s. And the narrative also focused on the fact that it was the Algerian. The Algerian had a revolution, a democratic revolution, in late 1980s. They were in a matter overnight in 1989. We went from a one-party system to a multi-party system. And for about a year and a half, they saw democratic change. And they granted, but what happened afterwards was damaging. When the Front Islamic Salvation won the elections and the military intervened, the country was drawn into a civil war, as I said earlier, about 200,000 people killed as of today. And what the military did and the government, the current government in Algeria, and in the media as well, is to remind people that, look, we were there, we had a democratic change, and it didn't work. And if we pursue this, we might get the same outcome. So it's better from their perspective to take a different path, which is a slow movement, a reform movement, and work with the current system. And that's exactly what has happened so far in Algeria.
Well, Hamoud Salih, let's turn to Libya, where clearly there has been obviously a lot of violence. But there's also, I think, a lot of hope that relief that the dictator's gone. The stuff that you see on television, the people are actually quite optimistic about their futures.
Yes, yeah.
And I don't think you can deny the fact that they're better off without the Gaddafi kleptocracy and the police state that he had. And I'm sure people in Algeria have sympathy, you know, just on a people-to-people basis, surely, with the Libyans, don't they?
They do. And yeah. There is sympathy for the Libyans. There is sympathy for the fact that the revolution has succeeded. There is sympathy that the Libyans endured their struggle and they come on top. That's definitely registered. The government, however, has had a different approach towards this.
Sure.
I think we entered a stage of political gaming. In other words, this is when the Algerians are trying to put pressure on the new government to see them take a path that would be consistent with their foreign policy, with the Algerian outlook to the region. Let's not forget, this region itself is deeply divided. You have Algerians and Moroccan are in deep conflict over the Western Sahara issue. The countries are involved in an arms race in a power struggle of the region. The same thing with Tunisia and Algeria. The relationship has not been that good. At the same time, relationship with Gaddafi for a long time, they were on good terms. Both the president, Bouteflika, and Gaddafi were good buddies in the 80s, and I'm sorry, in the 70s. They were seen as the leaders of the non-alignment, those who both countries had a consistent foreign policies. In the OPEC, the oil-producing, exporting countries. So they were allies on many fronts in the non-allied movement. So you have a history between those leaders. And I think that history is still there at this point and will continue to exist between the two leaders. But the Algerian government understands that it has to take the next step. And the next step is to ensure that those who are coming to power in Libya would be on their side or at least be influenced by the Algerian government. The alternative is to see them turn into Morocco, for example, the enemy of the Algerians, and that could be bad from the Algerian perspective. Mm-hmm. So it's really a lot of political gaming,
but
the revolution has been celebrated and is seen as a success, as something that the Libyans deserve, and definitely it's much better than what we've seen in the past decades or several decades that the Libyans have lived as a dependent country.
So, Hamoud Salih, let's turn to the proliferation of arms issue. And you've mentioned some of the tensions in the region that already exist between Algeria and Morocco, Tunisia and Algeria. Mm-hmm. These tensions are bound to be exacerbated by the enormous flows of arms into the south, by caravans into Agadez in Niger. Now we learn, of course, that some of the generals from Gaddafi's army and possibly members of the clan or even he himself are likely to show up there, although the government of Niger denies this. But my understanding is that Agadez for some time has been the destination for a lot of these looted arms from Libya, and they're going into the hands of the Tuaregs. And I take it that this is going to exacerbate tensions between Morocco and Algeria. There's all these arms flowing, right?
Oh, there is. It's a huge, huge problem. And the region, the countries of Mali, Algeria, Niger, have been looking at this for several decades now. There is currently there is a conference on combating terrorism in the region. United States is taking part in this conference. This is happening today and this week, and it's all about the flow of arms and what is described as terrorism in the region. The United States itself has spent millions and millions of dollars to combat terrorism. There is about, I believe, around $500 million allocated to combating terrorism in the countries of Tunisia, Morocco, and Morocco and Algeria. So there is a huge interest there, and a reason for it is the fact that that you have these countries are rich in oil. There are major American companies in the region, and if we do a bit of history, in 2004, Dick Cheney announced that the African oil is a strategic oil, and at that time, if we understand, the only other oil that has earned such a distinction is the Gulf oil, which tells us that the United States start to look at Africa from an oil perspective, and that it views the stability of the region as important to the survival of that product. And it's in that context that that region is being looked at. It's a region that is rich in oil, and it serves the American interests very well. If you go down to the desert in Sahara, in Algeria, where the oil is, and other places, it's you can't get in. You have to have a permit, even if you are a citizen, to get inside the camps where the oil is being produced. So it's a serious, serious business, and oil is a serious business. So from that perspective, the flow of arms, the problems with terrorist organizations will only exacerbate with an unstable Libya. And I think that's what's the goal these days for the Algerians and probably the other powers, to ensure that the transition in Libya would be as peaceful as possible, and it would not lead or contribute to the stability of the region in ways that would that the interest of those of the United States oil and strategic interest and the region itself be suffer.
So, what is the are the tribal fissures there? And what's the role of the Tuaregs, who apparently were fighting with Gaddafi, and now there's a lot of they have access to a lot of arms in Agadez?
Well, it's not just the Tuareg. The Tuareg is actually they're found throughout the region of northern Africa. The Tuareg are a subgroup of the Berber. They are a third or fourth group. They are nomads, so travel from one from one area to another area. They have over the years established good relationships with the with Gaddafi in the case of Libya. They have worked with him on providing him certain kind of stability, no challenges. So it is in that context. Gaddafi worked very well with the tribes. Not that he preached tribalism, but the irony is that he built his power around buying the tribal leaders, money, and so on and so forth. So it is in that context that the Tuaregs are becoming more of a nuisance. They are the one who knows the desert. They are the one who move from one area to another very quickly, and they are spread in the entire region from Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, and they all have a common bond that in fact there is a movement that see themselves as a united organization, a borderless or the state or the territories are not only located in one specific area, i.e. Libya or Algeria, but throughout the region. So they are Sahrawis who live in the desert, whose survival depends on many means, including the sale of arms. But you also have other terrorist organizations. Al-Qaeda is very active in the region, it has been for a long time. So those also are appearing as causing some problems for the regimes.
Well, of course, as it happens, it was the Berbers who go all the way across from Morocco through Algeria into Libya that in the West that mm-hmm. seemed to have been the main fighting force that got into Tripoli, and the Eastern rebels weren't making much progress. So. Obviously, the tribal picture is complex.
Very complex.
Well, I thank you for joining us and for filling us in. And I must say that I have not heard from anywhere in the media that, as you've told us, Professor Salhi, that it's quite possible that Gaddafi is hiding out in or being held in Algeria as a kind of bargaining chip by the Algerian government.
I think it makes sense for the Algerians to use him as a bargaining chip. I would not be surprised if he emerges, but you never know. These leaders have a way of emerging from different corners of the world.
Sure.
But the Algerians, rest assured, they are looking for ways to pressure the current transnational government council.
I thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Hamoud Salhi. He's a professor of political science at Cal State University Dominguez Hills. He's also a political commentator for Algerian radio and television and a columnist for the independent newspaper El Habar, The News, and a board member of El Chab Strategic Studies Center in Algiers. A native of Algeria, his areas of interest are ethnicity, democracy, developmental studies, and the foreign policies of the Maghreb states. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Nobel Prize-winning economist Dr. Joseph Stiglitz. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing, and joining us now is Dr. Joseph Stiglitz, a world-renowned Nobel Prize-winning economist and chair of Columbia University's Committee on Global Thought. During the Clinton administration, Dr. Stiglitz was a member of the Council of Economic Advisers from 1993 to 1995 and its chairman from 1995 to 1997. He then became the chief economist and senior vice president of the World Bank. Dr. Stiglitz's books include Globalization and Its Discontents, Making Globalization Work, and The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict, co-authored with Linda Bilmes. His latest book is Free Fall, America, Free Markets, and the Sinking of the World's Economy. He has an article out now, widely available on the web, The Price of 9/11. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joseph Stiglitz.
Nice to be here.
And the book that you and Linda Bilmes did earlier, you're saying that the costs of the war since 9/11 have already exceeded what were your conservative calculations back then, 3 years ago, of $3 to $5 trillion.
That's right. The additional cost, we were deliberately conservative in our estimates, and the one set of numbers that have come in considerably higher than we had anticipated was the very large number of fraction of those returning veterans that are disabled. It's approaching 50%, much higher than it was in previous wars. And the disabled are very expensive to provide medical care and provide disability benefits. So the cost of disability, we estimate over coming years, decades, will be somewhere between $650 and $950 billion.
And this involves 600,000 returning veterans have been treated so far in veteran facilities. So there must be degrees of injury.
Oh, that's right. One of the distinctive aspects of this war is that a very large fraction are coming back with multiple injuries. So it is not only that a larger fraction are coming back disabled, a larger fraction of those that are disabled are coming back with multiple disabilities.
And you don't, of course, and you can't factor in other social costs like veteran suicides and family breakups, etc.
No, we didn't. We didn't estimate the cost of that, but we have noted that those numbers too have been skyrocketing and far higher than we had anticipated.
Well, this is surely a big difference there from the $60 billion which the Bush administration told us that the war would cost from the beginning. You've written here, colossal incompetence met dishonest misrepresentation.
That's right. I don't know which was worse, but I do think they deliberately tried to hide the cost from the American people. And one of the things that we pointed out is that in their attempt to hide the cost, it led them to make some very bad decisions. For instance, not to provide body armor, not to purchase the mine-resistant vehicles that would have saved hundreds of lives and would have saved thousands of people from very severe disabilities. So their deception has been enormously costly to so many of our veterans.
Well, Joseph Stiglitz, they also didn't pay for it. They didn't budget this in the normal way. This was off the books as a supplemental.
That's right. And one of the things that, again, we point out is this is the first war in, I think, America's history, almost any country's history, that was entirely paid for, as we put it, on the credit card, entirely paid for by debt. In fact, as we started the war in 2003, and we were already running large deficits, President Bush engineered a tax cut that was well beyond our country's ability to afford.
And Joseph Stiglitz, of course, we all know the famous remark by Alan Greenspan that it was all about oil. But as far as I can tell, the United States has not been the beneficiary of any oil from Iraq. I'm not sure if anybody has. That oil's been off the market for a long time. Apparently, there are massive reserves there. It could be the largest, or certainly the second largest, oil reserves in the world. But that because of decades of neglect, it'll take a lot of investment to get it out. But clearly, the price of oil in the meantime has gone up, and surely you have to factor all these costs that you're telling us about have to be factored in. If
that's right, and that's why the costs are not just the budgetary costs. Sometimes people focus on the cost to our budget. That cost is enormous, but beyond the budgetary cost are the broader costs to the economy, and you put your finger on one of those major costs. The war disrupted the flow of oil, led to higher oil prices. Prices of oil were about $23 a barrel at the time we went to war. Futures markets, recognizing there would be increasing demand, anticipated there would be increases in supply so that the price of oil would remain around $23, $25 a barrel for the next decade. And we all know what happened then. It went from 25 to 50 to 100 to 140. This actually is very closely connected with the crisis that we're now going through, because when the oil started skyrocketing, Americans who were so dependent on imported oil were spending more and more of their money abroad rather than at home. And that would have led to a severe economic downturn. The Fed stepped in and prevented that from happening. What did they do? They had lax regulation, low interest rates. They created a bubble. So the bubble was how we kept the economy going in the face of high oil prices. And, of course, we now know the consequences of the bubble. When the bubble broke, the economy went into this deep recession. It's already 3 years since the recession began, almost 4 years. It'll be 4 years in December. And the official unemployment rate is 9%, a little over 9%. But in fact, 25 million Americans who would like a full-time job can't get one.
And if, of course, Dr. Stiglitz, if Alan Greenspan is right, then you'd have to saying this was all about oil, this war, then you have to factor the cost of the war in and add that to the price of oil, right? I mean, if you accept his logic.
That's right. The overall point, though, is that we should have done a more careful calculation. This was a war of choice. We didn't have to. It had no relations to 9/11, no relation to Al-Qaeda, even though the Bush administration, part of its deceptive marketing of the war was that there was a connection. We now know that there was absolutely no connection. And so when you have a war of choice, you have to think about the benefits and the costs. And any cold calculus of those benefits and costs would certainly raise the specter that we would lose, and we did lose very badly.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize-winning economist. He has an article out now widely available on the web, The Price of 9/11. But surely adding to the 3 to 5 trillion plus that you've added, and you've adding up to 900 billion extra for the extra costs of the wounded and maimed and the psychologically scarred veterans, surely the Colin Powell warned about, the terrorist industrial complex, has happened. There's a study from Dana Priest and William Arkin, Top Secret America, that outlines what's happened since 9/11. And various people, John Mueller at Ohio State, say it's about, we spent about $1 trillion domestically since 9/11 on Homeland Security. What's your understanding of the?
Well, there are many, several aspects of this. In more accounting in our book, we only attributed to the war a fraction of the increased spending by the Defense Department that was not allocated to the war. I mean, the interesting thing, even though the Cold War was over, as the war on terrorism went up, so-called war on terrorism went on, defense spending went up way more than the what was being spent in Iraq and Afghanistan. We attributed about a quarter of that increase to the wars, and that meant that there were still hundreds of billions of dollars additional money going into defense. And I think in one way or another, much of that was generated, as you call it, by the military-industrial terrorism complex, and the contractors and the others were making large profits out of what was going on. One of the things we pointed out in this article is the large fraction of money that went to the contractors that has now been identified as wasted and corrupt.
Well, I suppose, though, if you do have a war on terror, which is the overall backdrop to these other two wars we've had, you could count it as the third war, and therefore, if we spent $1 trillion on Homeland Security, then that has to be added in, surely.
That's right. So I don't know how you calculate the total amount when you look at Homeland Security, but just looking at the increased Defense Department expenditures since 9/11, you'd have to say it's somewhere around $2.5 trillion, and that doesn't include the debts that we will have to pay. Again, about $1 trillion, for instance, for disabled returning veterans. So these wars, as you might call them, have been extraordinarily expensive. Needn't be. They could have been waged in a much more intelligent way. And that was one of the points that we raised, that because the way we did it was not as thoughtful as it could have been, the costs have been much larger than they needed to have been.
Well, surely you're being polite when you say it wasn't thoughtful. It was dishonest, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, it was dishonest. But even within the dishonesty, you would have thought they could have carried out their mission with greater thought and greater intelligence. And I think what is so striking is how badly the whole enterprise was carried out. And as I say, I think the two issues are somewhat related because they were trying to deceive Americans, because they were using deceptive accounting and they didn't have the numbers, they didn't have the administrative processes, the accountability that would have, I think, checked against some of these abuses. And it's why we want, in all aspects of government, more transparency. When you have more transparency, there are more people looking over what is being done, and therefore a greater ability to correct mistakes when they occur.
Well, it's an extraordinary contrast if you think about George Bush Sr.'s foreign policy and his war in Iraq, where the war was paid for by the Japanese and the Saudis, and the U.S., after Saddam had been kicked out of Kuwait, the U.S. still had a hegemonic control of that part of the world, and which, after all, is the oil supplies of our economic rivals in Europe and in Asia. Now, because of the bungling by Bush Jr., the U.S. hegemony is all but shredded. Our rivals are making separate oil deals and getting in where they can. And the price of oil, I think, is going to be permanently high, isn't it? Because the Saudi regime is so afraid of the Arab Spring that they have to bribe their younger generation so that they won't take to the streets. And that means at least $100 a barrel oil, doesn't it?
Well, I think the likelihood that the price of oil will remain, as you say, at least at $100 is very high. One of the things I spent some time in the last year in the Middle East, and one of the things that is so clear is the anger with the United States. We wanted to win influence, demonstrate our power. Instead, we lost power. We lost power in three ways. We lost power militarily, in a sense, because we showed that a country that was spending close to one half of all the money that was being spent around the world couldn't really pacify, win effective control over two very small pieces of land fighting against two very relatively poor countries. So the credibility of our military power was compromised, and now they know, most other countries know, that we will be reluctant to use power. So rather than increasing the credibility of our military power, it's decreased. Secondly, more important than military power is always sometimes called soft power, our moral authority. And that was compromised by the way we compromised basic human rights, violated international law, violated the International Convention on torture, did other things that received widespread global disapproval. And then finally, at the root of America's power is its economy. And the way the war was conducted clearly has weakened the U.S. economy. So on all three scores, these wars have really undermined the strength of the U.S.
And I imagine when you're in the Gulf, Joseph Stiglitz, you got an earful about how the crash in 2008 eviscerated a lot of the sovereign wealth funds of these countries, didn't it?
Well, many of them have recovered a little bit from that. Some of them are still having problems, maybe not fully recovered. I think the thing there that, of course, is rather galling is the double standard, where we went around the world, told other countries to open up their markets to our investors, and yet when Dubai wanted to invest in America's ports, we said, no way. And, of course, China had a similar experience. So there is a sense in many of these countries that there's a double standard, a kind of hypocrisy. And that, of course, also doesn't win friends and influence people.
But do they trust Wall Street with their money anymore?
No. But that's a rather different matter. I mean,
sure.
that's really the Wall Street's been shown not to be able to perform the basic functions of financial markets. Financial markets are supposed to allocate capital, manage risk, and clearly our financial markets misallocated capital and created risk. So the confidence in our financial markets has been clearly eroded. The bubble to which lax regulation and low interest rates that were in some sense, as I said before, associated with trying to offset the fact that we were spending so much on importing oil has really cost America a lot in its economic leadership.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I know the last time we spoke was a while back when we talked about when you were concerned about Europe and not having a kind of Federal Reserve and having to rely on this European Central Bank, and you were concerned that problems in the non-Eurozone in the East may creep across to the West. But interestingly enough, something different happened. There's a North-South divide now in Europe, isn't there? Between the...
That's right. That's a rather different issue. But
yeah, I know. I just wanted to. I just recall our last conversation. You know,
when the euro was founded, many of us were skeptical. What we were aware of is they had taken away two of the instruments of adjustment, interest rate and exchange rate mechanism, and they hadn't put anything in its place. And we all said, oh, you know, things will go well as long as things are going well, but when a crisis happens, in the absence of these adjustment mechanisms, without anything replacing it, is going to mean trouble. And that is precisely what happened. And what I find deeply disturbing is that while the euro was, the founding of the euro was supposed to bring Europe together, it's really divided it. And the lack of solidarity that's so evident as Europe debates what to do with Greece and Spain and Ireland and Portugal and Italy, the lack of solidarity is really undermining European unity.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Joseph Stiglitz.
Sure, thank you. Okay.
Bye-bye. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Joseph Stiglitz, a world-renowned Nobel Prize-winning economist and chair of Columbia University's Committee on Global Thought. During the Clinton administration, Dr. Stiglitz was a member of the Council of Economic Advisers and later the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisers. He then became the chief economist and senior vice president of the World Bank. And his latest book is Free Fall, America's Free Markets and the Sinking of the World's Economy. Prior to that, he wrote The $3 Trillion War, The True Cost of the Iraq Conflict. Now he has an article out, widely available on the web, The Price of 9/11. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the shrinking middle class.
I learned a good way.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Erin Currier, who is the project manager for the Economic Mobility Project at the Pew Charitable Trusts. Prior to her current position, she served as the vice president for programs and policy at Women's Work, at the National Network for Women's Employment. The Economic Mobility Project can be found at www.economicmobility.org. Welcome to Background Briefing, Erin Currier.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the study that you've just released from the Pew Charitable Trusts suggests that the American dream is in trouble, and the middle class is shrinking, and that a middle class upbringing does not guarantee the same status over the course of the lifetime of one's lifetime. And particularly disturbing is the idea that nearly one in three Americans who grew up middle class have slipped down the income ladder as an adult.
I think that's right. You know, the Economic Mobility Project's goal is to understand the best facts and figures related to mobility. And we really are seeking to foster an informed, nonpartisan discussion about the health and status of the American dream. And so all of our research looks at mobility across generations and within a generation, and what factors matter for people moving up and down the income ladder, and whether those factors matter differently depending on a person's race or gender. And some of the research that we have done prior to this report shows both a glass half full and a glass half empty when we think about economic mobility prospects. On the one hand, if you look just at people's income in inflation-adjusted dollars compared to their parents, the vast majority of Americans do actually have higher family incomes. And I think that makes a lot of sense when you think about the fact that we have had strong economic growth and incomes are rising, and you have an increase in two-earner families. And so people do have greater income available to them. But at the same time, where we see a glass half empty is that a lot of people tend to remain stuck in the position that they are on the income ladder as a whole. So those whose parents were at the bottom of the income distribution tend to remain at the bottom, and those who were at the top tend to remain at the top. Where we don't see that stickiness, though, is in the middle. And this report was really aiming to understand how the middle class in particular is experiencing economic mobility. So for this report, we defined it just as the 30th to the 70th percentile of the income distribution. And as you said, we found that almost a third of Americans whose parents were middle class fall out of the middle class themselves.
And in terms of your methodology, that group is judged by a family of four with an income between $33,000 and $64,000 in 2010 dollars.
Yep, right.
But it's very, isn't it important though to mention here that this study started back in 1979, I believe, with 12,000 respondents. And ended in 2007. So the findings do not cover the difficult times the nation's just gone through since the crash of 2008.
Right, exactly. The Economic Mobility Project really takes the long view. You know, we're looking at real parent-child pairs, and we're comparing across generations with an eye to understanding what happens to Americans' mobility in good times and in bad. And I think the really critical thing about this study is that this does not take into account the most recent economic recession. And so what we're seeing is kind of an unvarnished view of what Americans' mobility looks like, even in strong economic times.
And the within the group that have let me ask you the broader question, though, because I think this is on a lot of people's minds, particularly parents. And the notion is that our parents always assume that they'd be handing off a better world to us and better opportunities. And have we reached that threshold where we cannot look our children in the eye and tell them that we can guarantee them a better future than we had?
It's such a great question. And I think, again, it sort of depends on how you measure it. So if you look at the absolute mobility, which is just looking at people's income over generations, as I mentioned, we see definitely a glass half full. In a lot of ways, Americans have higher living standards than their parents did. We live in larger houses now. We have more income available to families. We have much more amenities than we used to. And so in that sense, yes, you know, if you you see a lot of optimism among Americans in public polling that we've done, I think because they feel that. They feel that they have more money than their parents did and that they're in a better spot. Where there's more concern, though, is this question of whether the United States really is a meritocracy and whether we are actually fostering change in where a person falls within the income distribution. So if someone's parents were in the bottom income quintile and they happen to have more money over the next generation than their parents did, they might feel like they're better off, but they don't necessarily have enough money to move them out of the bottom. And it's the position of our project that equality of opportunity is what matters, not necessarily equality of outcomes, and that some of the evidence that we have from our data would suggest that that equality of opportunity is not always there.
Well, I know it's somewhat unrelated, Aaron Currier, but last night I happened to be watching that one of those dreadful showbiz kind of shows like Extra, they did a profile on this daughter of a billionaire from England who's a billionaire from Formula One racing. Her name is Petra Eccleston, and she's famous here in Los Angeles because she bought the most expensive house on the market, the $65 million Aaron Spelling mansion. And they showed her closet with a collection of handbags, each of which cost over $30,000, which I'm just relating it to the measure of the middle class here in your study is a family of four earning $33,000 a year. Each of these handbags, and they literally went as far as the eye can see, is the equivalent of a family income that for those holding on at the bottom of the middle class.
Right. It's kind of amazing. And I think, I think one of the most interesting things about our study actually is not necessarily the aggregate number of who's falling out of the middle, but that there are stark differences in who falls out of the middle depending on race and depending on sex. So we see that African Americans are more likely than whites to fall out of the middle class, and that women are more likely than men to fall out of the middle class. And I think the more that you begin peeling back these layers of the onion, the more you're able to understand what the real implications are of these data, and also what kinds of policy changes might be able to be effective to sort of helping people maintain their status on the income ladder.
So one of the more disturbing aspects of your study, Aaron Currier, is that nearly half of African Americans born to middle-income parents in the late 1960s plunged into poverty or near poverty as adults.
Yes, we released a study back in 2008 that looked at income at income mobility across generations. And in that study, we divided the income distribution into five equal pieces. And if you take that middle piece, which is a slightly different definition of the middle than we used for this most recent report, you see that almost half, 45% of African Americans fall from the middle all the way to the bottom as adults, and only 16% of whites do. And this number was so stark to us and so stark to all of our coalition partners that we have spent some time in subsequent reports really trying to understand what could be behind that huge downward mobility gap. And that was really what inspired this report, so that we could better understand what factors like education, like marital status, like parents' occupation, what kinds of things really are driving that difference between black-white mobility. I think what we found is, in some ways, not so surprising. We know that post-secondary education is extremely important, and this report did find that those who have some post-secondary education are much, much more protected from falling down out of the middle than those who have only a high school diploma. And similarly, that those who are married are more likely to maintain their middle-class status than those who are not.
Or that are divorced and separated.
Exactly. Right. And you know, that's not also not surprising when you consider that we have so much of an increase in two-earner families. When you can rely on a spouse or partner for your income stability, that helps a lot.
Well, Erin, I thank you so much for joining us, and I thank you for your report, which is available at www.economicmobility.org. Thanks again. Again, I've been speaking with Erin Currier, the Project Manager for the Economic Mobility Project at the Pew Charitable Trusts. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with an Algerian scholar who appears on Algerian television and radio, and he is a part of an Algerian think tank. He also is a professor over here. His startling revelation was that he believes that the Algerian government is not just sheltering members of Gaddafi's family, but they're actually sheltering Gaddafi himself as a bargaining chip with the new transnational council next door in Libya, who they're very leery of. They don't trust NATO. They don't trust the idea that that Libya may host a big NATO base. The U.S. apparently is looking for a base in that part of the world, according to Professor Hamoud Salhi. We talked a lot about the fissures in that area already. There's tension and a war on the border between Algeria and Morocco and Tunisia and Morocco. There's tension in Algeria, and of course, Gaddafi got on well. And even though there's a lot of the Algerian people themselves are quite happy to see Gaddafi go, the government isn't, because they were quite close. Now, he also talked a lot about the flow of arms going into the south, into Niger. There's a huge arms bazaar in Agadez. This is going to destabilize the region further with all these tribal wars that are going on. And there's a lot of oil in that part of the world. And he believes that there's a huge agenda there on the part of the United States to move in and try and control that oil in the Sahara. And then we talked with Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz. He has an article out now available on the web called The Price of 9/11. Previously, he wrote a book about the $3 trillion war in Iraq, and he said that their original conservative calculation of $3 to $5 trillion, you have to add to that at least another trillion for the extra costs of the wounded from these wars, which is staggering. Plus, you have to add another trillion for homeland security. Then the continued high price of oil is not likely to go down again in the near future. He paints an absolute picture of catastrophe that George W. Bush did, and explains the how much U.S. power has been diminished, its prestige has been diminished since 9/11, and not, perhaps not news to everybody, but nevertheless, really chilling statistics and a very chilling analysis of how wrong-footed the U.S. has been since 9/11, and how we effectively shot ourselves in the foot, dug a huge hole in the sand somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and buried trillions and trillions of our treasure for no good purpose. Then we talked about the shrinking state of the middle class and the end of the American dream for a lot of people. We had the Erin Currier, Project Manager of the Economic Mobility Project at the Pew Charitable Trust. They've just released this new study that finds nearly one-third of Americans who grew up in the middle class in the 1970s have fallen out of the middle class as adults. She further went on to explain how the economic mobility in this country slowing down, the middle class is shrinking, and opportunity is shrinking for people to enter the middle class. And it's no guarantee that once you, a middle class upbringing does not guarantee that you keep that status in the course of your lifetime. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.